This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Good morning, horse people. This is Coach Jen from Ocala, Florida, and you're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for February 18th, 2016, episode 1363.
Thursday. I'm so happy it's Thursday.
Just an ordinary day.
If you love to ride horses, but you'd rather ride on a trail than in an arena, I think I know a sport just for you.
We're out. We're getting to the first mark. We're a little ahead of time.
Expect nothing less than full-blown chaos.
Well, greetings, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Alice is busily gathering stories at the NATRC convention today, so sit back and enjoy this carrot-infused brand mash of her favorite interviews from previous shows. Alice will be back again next month live on the third Thursday with lots of trail riding news and advice and interesting characters.
Well, let's continue with the show so you can get on and get your tires and things. We have coming up as our first guest. Why don't you tell us who we got?
Our first guest is Debbie Sharp. She has been a fitness professional for over 35 years and has owned her own Pilates studio and has done video and print. She decided to focus on Pilates use in whatever she was doing, like with horseback riding, or look at how Pilates can affect sports, and began that about 13 years ago. And since 2008, she has been giving her mat-to-saddle Pilates clinics that teach strength, balance, and feel to give the rider a better seat, fluidity, suppleness, and the ability to enhance communication with their horse. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about what you do and about how Pilates can help us as riders.
Okay. It's a subject I'm well-versed on and very passionate about. When I think about Pilates and I think about riding, they end up being pretty much the same thing. For example, my clinics are named Strength, Balance, and Feel. And if you put that in a triangle, two of them are associated with the other one and vice versa. You need balance and feel to have strength. You need feel to have strength and balance. And all of that ties in, and Pilates does that. And everything I teach in Pilates, it's what our horses have or want from us. So it's perfect. They want us to be present. We need to be present for them in their movement, in their bodies. They're reading our body language all the time. And if we are clearer in our body language and signals, then that helps them, whether it's on the ground or in the saddle. Pilates requires you to be present and in your body, because you're not just using the big global muscles, the muscles that you can look in the mirror and see. You're using the intrinsic muscle system, which are the deepest muscles in the body. And those are the muscles that create efficiency and ease of movement and suppleness.
Debbie, fluidity. Before you go on, can I ask you, for those of us that are lazy bums like me, what exactly is Pilates? I've heard of Pilates, and I've heard people talk about Pilates, but what exactly do you do? What exactly is it?
Okay. Pilates was created by Joseph Pilates back in the 20s. At the time, it was called Contrology, and he was brilliant way before his time. Pilates is about looking at efficient movement, and he created quite a series of movements and quite a series of equipment to enhance and teach that. Pilates is about moving the body with efficiency, which means that some of my advanced athletes come in and will leave sweating profusely, but go, what's next? Rather than when you go in the gym and you focus on the big global muscles, the muscles you can see, and in fact are predatory muscles is what they are when you were in the horse world, then you end up being quite fatigued because you're overusing. So Pilates is about precision, efficiency, learning how to move with your core, moving from your core or with your core rather than moving with a bracy or stiff back. Does that help a little bit?
And it's similar to, I know I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, it's similar to yoga. If we were to look at it, it would kind of remind us of yoga.
Yeah, you're getting in trouble for that.
Okay, see? I knew I would.
It is.
But it's been compared. I've seen it compared to yoga, and that's why I brought that up.
Right.
Yeah.
What I like to tell people in a very short layman's version is if you are looking for more lengthening, do yoga. Pilates is sort of the athlete's version of yoga if you wanted to compare them. I'm doing that again. All of my nature to do that, but
kind of makes sense though. I mean, the way
Okay. So that's the difference. In Pilates, we learn how not only to execute a movement, but we learn why and how.
Got it. All right. You can continue now. I think that helps.
Okay. Okay. Good. Yes. It's, you know, I live this, so sometimes I don't quite give as much of an explanation to the rest of the world that doesn't. But so what I can focus on a little bit here is what the components of Pilates do for rider fitness. And it actually starts at the bottom of your body in the feet. Pilates is done barefoot. There are 26 bones, 33 joints, 107 ligaments, and 19 muscles in each foot. Joseph Pilates believed that if you don't have your feet, you don't have anything. And we ride in boots. We walk around in high heels. We do everything but walk around all the time barefoot. So foot and ankle strengthening is really quite important. If you've ever ridden for a couple hours out on the trail and you get off and your ankles are hurting, they're sore, you don't quite feel stable in the saddle if you're posting, that's ankle strength that you need. So we work on ankle strength. And I actually, on my website, I posted several short workouts, 7-8 minute workouts that you can go to and just pull up on YouTube and it'll give you this sweet little workout. Very effective. So ankle strength, very important to riding. If you move up the body a little bit, we have hip flexors. If you work in an office and sitting a lot, driving in your car a lot, whatever you're doing a lot, even running can tighten up the hip flexor, specifically the psoas muscle, which is the only muscle in the body that connects the spine directly to the leg and bypasses the pelvis. Hence, you can see if a psoas muscle is too lax or too tight, it affects your low back. So a lot of times people spend so much time stretching it, they don't see if it's active. The psoas muscle is very important in posting because it actually helps lift you and lower you and keep your pelvis in neutral, keep your spine in neutral. So that's an important part of the body to focus on. Then we come to your core. Now, core has become the buzzword for ab classes everywhere. And ab classes are not necessarily core classes. Ab classes are usually focused on the rectus abdominis. It runs from your sternum to the pubic bone. It is a spinal flexor. It doesn't stabilize the pelvis. It doesn't hold in your guts. It doesn't give you a flat tummy. It is a flexor. Just like the big muscles in your back, the spinal erectors are flexors and extensors for the spine. We have to go deeper. And the deepest abdominal muscle is the transversus. It girdles the lower part of your body, literally running horizontal, girdling it. That is the muscle that will support your back if you let it. So the core is a three-dimensional space in the body. The front of the core is the transversus muscle. The bottom of the core is the pelvic floor, very overlooked. Thousands of pages have been written on it. People still don't understand it. I would love to give you a version of the simple version of what the pelvic floor is and does, but the bottom line is it's thousands of pages. It is a go, seek, and find contraction. At the bottom of the torso, there are four muscles that comprise the pelvic floor. They hold your guts in. Look up pelvic floor. Pilates training will give you that. Like I said, I don't want to get into it at length. We don't have hours. The top of the core is the bottom of the breathing diaphragm, which means your core requires breath. When you hold your breath in a wonderful little exercise, if everybody will just take a deep breath in right now and hold it as long as you can, what you'll start to feel is the back tightening up. It is the back's job to brace when your body stops breathing. So that's not going to work really well in the saddle, because the moment you start bracing and holding your breath, your horse is going to go, okay, if my leader up here is getting a little tense, then when am I going to die? So breathing and moving the diaphragm helps increase the intensity of the core. The back of the core is the little multifidus muscles. They run up and down your spine. They take care of themselves. Those are the least of our problems. So the core is most importantly in charge of pelvic stability. You are much more stable if you have fluidity and suppleness rather than a rigidity and a brace. Your horse is better off that way. You're better off that way. And in truth, what I think about with rider fitness is what can I do to become more helpful to my horse, associate more into the movement of their body rather than fight with them all the time. And these are these are the quick versions of the importance of your body to help your horse and to be more in tune and to be a better rider and to everybody be happy. When you move up the body a little bit more, you get into the postural muscles, the rhomboid muscles, which sort of help the scapula or your shoulder blade stay back in control. And there's so much to it. And this is all involving the intrinsic muscle system. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It makes a lot of sense. It sounds complicated, though.
It's complicated until you start putting the puzzle pieces together and you see how really easy it is. Like I said, I wish there were some just really simple way to get everybody into their intrinsic muscle system, because that's sort of where your horses stay. They are efficient. You watch them running across the pasture. They are efficient. They don't waste energy. Even when they're kicking up and, bucking across the pasture because they're just all happy to be out again, they're still efficient in that movement. And we start to change their efficiency by our own imbalances. So to me, my job is to be the best body that I can be for my horse. And Pilates is just the best way I have found to do that.
So Debbie, with yoga, it tends to be a series of slow movements that it is not repetition like you would in a workout. Is Pilates have repetition to it for each one of these muscle groups, or is it kind of in between?
Pilates does have repetition.
Okay. You know what I was asking. I wasn't sure I was asking it right. So, yeah. Okay.
Right. Because it is a workout.
Right.
And
it's actually a strengthening exercise also.
It is.
Yeah.
And in Pilates, we strengthen through lengthening. So the focus tends to be, rather than like in the gym, where your focus is shortening muscles, like a bicep curl,
right?
A concentric movement, which is shortening a muscle under load. Pilates focuses on lengthening a muscle under load, which is the eccentric contraction. And we're now finding that eccentric work is actually more beneficial to building strength and endurance.
Well, and I bet you see 90, you know, not, it's been in the past 99% women and 1% men. But I will say this. I've been talking to a lot more professional riders in eventing and dressage and jumping who men and women are taking Pilates classes now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I guess it depends on where you are in the country. You go into the larger cities, you have a lot more men in the classes and you have a lot more men teaching.
Right.
But yeah, but the Pilates is really coming into the equestrian world. Well, it has been, but it's even becoming more so because people are understanding that the principles of Pilates are the principles of riding.
They're the same thing. Yeah.
They're the same thing.
Well, this is fascinating. How do people get started? What do they do? What's the first thing? Are there beginners classes? Should they get tapes? You know, what do they do?
I don't recommend the videos for beginners because it really is because it's your intrinsic work, you know, your intrinsic muscle system. People tend to just move like they do in the gym. And with a trainer or even in a class, you're going to get more attention and be taught how to find your core, how to move efficiently. Now then, a lot of mat classes are all over the place, and that's certainly the less expensive way to go, but it's also the hardest thing you can do. The equipment work is actually easier in that it gives you some help with movement. There are equipment classes, and then, of course, I'm just a real advocate of if you can, get a private training, get a trainer for a private sessions for a few of them until you really learn where the depth of this work is. And then, yes, you can do the videos. Yes, you can do the mat classes and all sorts of things. And then of course, there are clinics for equestrians all around, and that's part of what I do with mat to saddle, which is sort of like your Pilates mat to get in the saddle.
You know, and to be honest, and if we're all honest, it is very difficult. There's a very small percentage of the population that have the wherewithal and the fortitude to do the videos for more than two or three times, and then they quit. At least going to the classes and going someplace to do it, and if you're with other people or not, it forces you to do it. And I think that's, you know, that self-discipline is tough.
It's called accountability, and it's very tough.
It is tough. And, you know, if we're honest, you know, we all like to think that we could get a video and we could do it day after day after day after day for weeks and months on end. And, you know, and that would be great. And there are some people that can do that. But, you know, the percentage is better than me. It can't be 5%.
It's that.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's why Craigslist and eBay is full of videos and equipment and everything else.
Exactly. those treadmills that we use three times and then it sits there and you throw your clothes all over it from the bedroom. And that's where your dirty clothes sit, is on the treadmill. I bet you more treadmills hold dirty clothes than human bodies.
I would not doubt that.
Yeah, I would too. Well, where can people find you?
They can find me online at mattosaddle.com or the PilatesBodyLoss.com. If you can get to either of those, they're links to the other one. Mat to Saddle is where I talk about rider fitness and my clinics. I travel all over doing my clinics and would be glad to go to Barnes to help people. But and so that's where you can find me. Phone numbers, et cetera, emails, et cetera, are both there.
Very good. And the website again is mat2tosaddle.com. Very simple and easy to remember. We'll post it on our Facebook page at Horses in the Morning and also in our show notes at horsesinthemorning.com. Thank you so much, Debbie Sharp.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
Well, coming up next, we're going to have our song for you, and then we're going to come back with Leslie Walker David of Texas Hay Net. We're going to talk about round bales and some of the things that happens with those, and we've all had experience with those. Anybody who's used a round bale knows the pitfalls of round bales and knows the advantages, too. Well, for your product review this week, I know we're going to get your daughter involved, who you're just talking about. Maggie was kind enough to join Reese Coffler Stanfield and I on the Dressage Radio Show and talk a little bit about the Total Saddle Fit Shoulder Relief Girth. And we're going to hear all about that right now. Well, Reese, you know, we've been talking about the shoulder relief girth from Total Saddle Fit for a long time. And it's been you and I doing the talking and Philip and, you know, just all of us, right? And now we had a meetup. I told you about it earlier in the show in Texas with some listeners and some of the hosts from the Horse Radio Network when I was there over the weekend. And I met this young girl who actually uses the girth not for dressage, but for something else. And her name is Maggie. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. I use that girth for trail riding mostly.
But you compete because too, right? You compete
yes, I compete. Yeah. Trail riding, competitive trail riding mostly is what I do. And so I always had a really hard time keeping my horses from getting girth galls because they're big round horses and their girth rub them really bad. And we found this girth and we went ahead and was like, well, let's try it. It doesn't hurt. And I have absolutely loved it for the ride. And it's such a nice girth, you know, nice leather, and it stood up really nice for the miles that I've done.
And you guys do a lot of miles, too.
Yeah, we're doing some fast, hard work, too. And it has done wonders for my little Arab that I've been using. His girth gets up in his elbow really bad, and it has helped him so much.
What kind of saddle do you ride in?
I ride in a Specialized saddle, a little endurance Specialized saddle. I have a really old one, not one of the new fancy ones. But
sometimes the oldies are better. I'm telling you.
Yes.
The oldies are better. They're broken in.
Yeah, this is a great saddle. It's had, five different owners, and most of them are still doing nature today. They're just like, oh, I need a different saddle. And it's like, oh, well, I'll have it. You know, it's just one of those things. It's like the travel, you know, the sisterhood of the traveling pants. It's the traveling saddle.
I love it. That's so cute. Well, and Maggie, I've also had really good luck with a Total Saddle Fit shoulder relief girth on my mare Jamaica, and we call her Meepy, and she's older and also a little bit on the rotund side. She was retired, and yes. I put her back to work this summer, and I asked Justin, I said, how will the girth work on kind of a plumper individual? And we were having also the same issue with girth galls, and it's been fantastic. She has not gotten a girth gall or anything, so I have also had great luck with a little more rotund in the belly.
Yeah, I am. I also use it on my other little mare who is definitely very rotund, and she's a lot of excess skin in her elbow, so it just kind of gets caught up in there, and it has been great on her too, you know, once again rotund. And so yeah, it's been a lifesaver, because that's one of the things that I've always had problems with my mare and this new gelding. I've always had trouble with girth galls. Just because they get up too far in their elbows, or they just rub wrong, and I've always had problems with that, and that's a bunch of points that I get taken off. And when I found this girth, I have, you know, it minimized it, if not completely gone, on my girth.
You know what I've determined? Your horses all need a diet. That's what I've determined.
Oh, you be nice. You be nice to those
horses.
Hey, I got a pony that's so fat too. And you know what? We have the same problem with our saddles for the harness, for the driving. He gets the rub marks just like you guys are getting. And unfortunately, Total Saddle Fit doesn't do a girth yet for driving. Maybe someday.
I think he's been asked to do it.
Yes,
I know.
He has been asked before to do it. But thank you so much, Maggie, for letting
us
know.
Thanks, Maggie.
All right, good. Well, we're ready with your next guest.
All right, our next guest is Melissa Neal from Cold River Equine, Arc Medicine and Rehabilitation Center. She has been a horsewoman for over 30 years and started her business in Burney, Texas. She realized the need for post-operative care and conditioning of equine athletes and is now located in Crescent, Texas. And she's here to tell us about what she does at her facility, including her rehabilitation and lessons. So, Melissa, it's great to hearing from you today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, first of all, tell us a little bit about your facility. I have gotten to use your aqua tread several times with my horses, and I just think your whole setup is really cool. So tell us a little bit about your facility.
Oh, thank you. We are located in the triangle between Weatherford, Fort Worth, and Granbury, so it's very convenient for traveling. We are housed on 15 acres. We have 30 stalls, an aqua tread, which is an underwater treadmill, the Equicizer, which is a tie-free hot walker, and then we also have therapy units such as pulse electromagnetics, E-stem, laser, and ultrasound.
So what are some of the benefits to horses using your facilities for conditioning? What are you able to do for them that people wouldn't be able to accomplish on their own, especially in the summertime?
Well, of course, you know, in the summer in Texas, we have to deal with the heat. And a lot of people are heat intolerant, and horses as well. You have to worry about over-conditioning and then developing anhidrosis, which is the inability to sweat, which is kind of stems from small heat strokes from what I've been told by veterinarians. So the wonderful benefit of the aqua tread is it's an opportunity for them to cool their core temperature for 15 to 20 minutes in the water. There's also the benefit that you can't get from riding, which is muscle mass. The resistance of the water from the horses pushing forward against that, it develops the forearms and the chest and the hindquarters and the gaskins much more than just long trotting and loping in the arena.
Now, my driving pony loves water. I think he would jump in this thing and just have a blast. Now, is it hard to get some horses in it?
Well, you bet. Of course. It's so foreign. If this was sitting out in the pasture, would they walk in it? No way.
No. Well, mine might, actually. He loves water, so he might.
Yeah. Some are part Labradors, and they love to just jump right in. But it takes patience. It takes skill, and it takes repetition. So what we do to get the horses in, first and foremost, I like to always say that we do not sedate horses to get them into the aqua tread. We take
well,
yeah,
time. That's probably a good idea. You don't really want her head sagging while they're in the aqua tread.
Well, it wouldn't be that much tranquilizer, but I just don't believe in it. You know, every horse goes at their own cognitive ability. And if it takes me 30 minutes to get them in the pool to work them out for 10, so be it. Because tomorrow it'll only take me 10 and then 5 and then they walk in like a seasoned pro. But it's based on positive reinforcement. We ask for one step forward at a time. Stop, praise, let their heart rate come down, let them deal with what we're asking them to do, and then we go forward again.
So it's similar to getting them in the trailer. I mean, ones that have trouble trailering, it's the same thing. I mean, it's the same thing as really training them to do anything. Now, are there some that just never like it, or do all of them seem to adapt and then, you know, after 4 or 5 times just hop in?
Well, in the 8 years that I've been using the aqua tread, I cannot think of one horse who just does not think it's the bomb once they figure it out. They love it.
It's got to be. It's like us swimming, right? I mean, same thing. Now, is it expensive? Because, I'm asking all these questions because 99% of us have never done this with our horses and probably would have never considered doing it. So that's why I'm asking these questions, because it's something that you would say not just for rehabilitation, but also in general would be a good workout for your horse, right?
Yes, it is. And it breaks the monotony of what you do with your horse. You run out of different ways to exercise and condition. And by putting them in the pool, it's mentally invigorating. They get their caloric burn, and then they can go back and take a power nap for the rest of the day. But no, it's extremely affordable. To put your horse in the pool just one time is $25. And
really?
For the work we really?
Now, I was picturing, to be honest with you, I had no idea, and I was picturing $100.
Woohoo! Hey, I'll for $100. No, it's very affordable. It's $25, and then when you buy packages of 5, 10, 15 swims, We cut you a little discount in there too when you buy in bulk. And we also have packages that have boarding. If you don't want a trailer back and forth, you live too far away or you're out of state, we can house them as well.
Huh. Interesting. So, and then you regulate, sorry, Alice, I'm hijacking you here.
Sorry,
you regulate, I just want to understand how this works because we've never talked about it here on the show before. So it is a treadmill type of situation. Is that right? Or is there a stream going at them? How's that work? How does it actually work?
How does it work? Underneath the water is a complex machine and that is a maintenance mongrel. So if you were thinking of putting one in, you're better off just to trailer over to me. It's a treadmill that we can vary the speed on, which is the beauty of it, of aqua treading versus swimming. The aqua tread, if you have a horse that's fresh out of surgery, they're not really allowed to do a lot of motion. Say your vet has prescribed hand walking for 5 minutes. Well, to put them in the aqua tread for that amount of time is so much more beneficial. We can slow that treadmill down to a snail's pace, and the horse is still traveling level, which is important to their physical development. So then the horse starts getting a little bit more strong. You can move it up to a power walk. Then once you get the vets okay and things are looking good, you can push them up to a trot for conditioning. So when the horse goes home, you don't have this jello-y, muscle poor, and totally anxious horse coming home. They've been exercised within restrictions, and their muscle mass is actually better than when they got hurt.
Okay, makes sense.
So I know you said that you have opportunities for people to board the horses there, so if they can't trailer back and forth. But like I know you also have your other exerciser. What kind of a program, like tell some of the things that you put together to make a conditioning program for people who maybe if they're going on vacation for a week or if they just need to leg the horses up for a couple weeks.
Oh, absolutely. A perfect example, a gal just dropped her horse off that's going to go ride up in the mountains in New Mexico. So our program for her horse is I have 3 weeks total. The first week is going to be nothing but the pool to get the horse going, get some cardio in it and put on some muscle mass, but not fatigue the horse too quickly. You have to be careful if they're really overweight or out of shape. Then the next week, we alternate between the equisizer, which is a tie-free hot walker, and the pool. The equisizer, you can go any program that you want. So you can just walk for 10 minutes, you can slow trot, you can extend a trot, and you can lope. My equisizer is large enough that if the horse goes on the outside wall and they don't cheat, then they can take in a full lope all the way around the 60-foot round pen. So
now the equisizer, you said that's the one that doesn't tie them by the head. That's the one that sort of pushes them with the gait, the gait.
Yes, correct. Yeah, okay. If they go too fast, they run into a wall. If too slow, it bumps them in the hindquarters. So then the last week that the horse is here, we will actually double up. We'll put them in the equisizer in the morning and the pool in the afternoon. So when you get your horse back, he's Hans and Franz and ready to tackle the mountain.
So, and besides the rehab, you also offer lessons and you've done some really interesting and unique obstacle training. Can you tell us about those?
Oh yes, you get diversified the longer you're in the horse industry, and somehow along the way I found the niche of desensitization clinics. This was my 11th year and my 48th class, and the clinics, they're high intensity. You're dealing with animals that are fearful and frightful of anything foreign, and we take that and change it into instead of being frightened of it, let's come over here and think about it together. Flip your brain from right brain to left. So the obstacles that I have out on the course, we have the full day of the desensitization clinic, but I also do obstacle training for competitive trail. So if you're having a sticky spot or you just need to round your horse out for desensitizing and getting them to master obstacles in the way that the judges like to score you highly, then I work with individuals on that as well.
So, one of the other things that I've always found really interesting about your business is that you recommend the use of chiropractic and acupuncture and herbs and things. Like you've helped several people
with their horses that had anhidrosis. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. You know, it's not one thing that is going to heal your horse. It's not one modality that's going to get you where you need to be. You can max out what Western medicine or Eastern medicine has to offer, but when you combine the two, you get a whole horse in the end. Acupuncture has been one of my leading benefits of finding that one thing that's just quite not right with your horse. They're off. You can't put your finger on it. Dr. Moss is wonderful about going into she like peels an onion down and she gets to the core of the problem. Is it a spleen, a liver? Is it just the neural pathways that aren't connected? A lot of this goes way over my head, which is why I hire it out. But the results I see are absolutely amazing. Chiropractics, that's for, you know, your basic core horse needs to have a square structure. If their pelvis is tilted, if their shoulder's jammed, if their neck is out, that horse is never going to function right. He's going to misfire at the barrel. He's not going to push off going up and down hills. When you go to work that cow and he has to cut back and he falls back on those hindquarters, if he's not right, he's going to start falling apart. Chiropractic should be a basic fundamental thing that everyone does to their horse at least 2 times a year. And that's pending nothing is wrong. That's just a good care regime. And then in conjunction with that, you get into the herbs. I try, you know, and stay away from the drugs that we prescribe. Now, of course, if you're a veterinarian, if they are in need of them, of course, absolutely. But then it has its side effects. And if you can find something that has a more natural origin without all the chemicals in it and still get the same result, it's best to transition to that once you get past the medical side of what they're needing the drugs for.
Well, I know that. Yeah. And Dr. Wendy Ying is a co-host of our driving radio show, and she does a traditional Chinese medicine segment every week with us on the driving radio show. And I got to tell you, I didn't know what to think about herbs and about acupuncture. And she does laser as well and all of those kind of things. But after hearing her talk about the traditional Chinese medicine and some of the things that they've been doing for thousands of years and now are really coming to the forefront, and mainstream, either veterinarians or people doctors, are starting to realize that they need to pay attention to this. And the problem is most veterinarians don't get any herbal training or any nutrition training of any degree at all in vet school or doctor school for that matter. So they're just coming to this on their own and starting to research it more. Chiropractors are starting to become involved more with the acupuncturists and things like that. So it really is an area that is growing like crazy right now. Have you seen the same thing? People are more accepting of it than they used to be 5 years ago.
Very much so. And it is thanks to our veterinarians that are opening their eyes and opening their minds to alternative therapies that aren't just taught in the Western doctorate field. It's about expanding yourself to encompass what the whole world has to offer. We get stuck in a rut in the United States and we don't venture out and go into what they call traditional Chinese medicine over there. You bring some of our medications over there and it's foreign and they shut their door to it as well. So it's about the community of medicine that we can benefit all of our animals if we just unite on that field.
Yeah, and you know, they're taught that. I mean, to their defense, they're taught that, you know, if there's something wrong, you have a pill, you have a surgery, you have something that physically you can do that way. And that's what they're taught in medical school. They're not really taught the alternatives. So the ones that, like you said, the ones that are really coming around to it have done it on their own after medical school. That's when they really pursued it and got some additional education about it.
Yes, absolutely.
And don't be afraid, and I think, Melissa, you'd probably back me up on this. Don't be afraid to ask your vet, you know, how do they feel about these things? And if you want a vet that is a little bit more open-minded, you're going to have to ask. I mean, you're going to have to, and don't be afraid to ask those questions. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, I agree. And there are certain vets out there that advertise themselves as alternative therapy doctors. So, you know, you have to be careful when you talk to your vet about alternative therapies, because some don't want to have anything to do with it, and they're going to try and persuade you away from it. And then you have others that embrace it. So you have to research what type, what style of doctor that you're looking for, and then narrow your search down to those.
Right, exactly. Alice?
I was going to ask Melissa, because we know each other from doing our competitive trail ride stuff, but I wanted her to talk a little bit about something new that she's taken on lately that I just have enjoyed watching her do on Facebook, which is the cowboy mounted shooting. I think you've just kind of started that in the last year or so, but you've been really successful with it. And I was just wanted you to talk about it a little bit.
Oh my gosh, guys, this is the bomb. I'm having so much fun. As we ride our horses through the years, you get into a sport and you kind of max it out and you move on to something else. And it's just one thing after another. I've done dressage and reining and barrels and competitive trail. And I've done all kinds of stuff, but I don't know. I had this hunch and talking with my friend and said, hey, you know, what do you think about this shooting stuff? You want to try it? Well, next thing you know, I'm out here like Annie Oakley going bananas, shooting, blowing up balloons and hitting targets. And it is so much fun. The cool thing about cowboy mounted shooting is the horsemanship that is involved in it. It's about perfecting your patterns and not letting your horse drop his shoulder in a turn. It's the rollbacks, the slide stops. There are 70 different patterns. So for people like me who like to multitask, I don't know what I'm faced with until I get there. And I love the element of surprise with that. And it's just you and your horse, your gun, and the clock. And there are no get out of jail free cards. How you get in there and shoot and run is just a direct reflection of your teamwork with your animal and how accurate you can be. But the people that do it are what has me hooked. They are so nice and friendly and open. Yeah, you're competing against everybody, but it's still a big brotherhood and sisterhood when you go. And for me, being a lower level shooter, I see some patterns that I've never seen before. And I can walk up to a world champion and say, I'm lost. Can you help me? And they're like, absolutely. And they think nothing of it. They're so warm and friendly.
I got to tell you, it's so funny because everybody that we've had on the show over the years that has gotten into mounted shooting, you've perked up when she asked that question, and your light went on and you became so bright and animated. And that happens every time we ask somebody who's just gotten into mounted shooting. Tammy Sarantz is the world champion mounted shooter and is a co-host on this show once a month. And, we've been talking to her for years, and it's just so much fun to watch it. And everybody has that reaction that gets into it.
She's my instructor.
Is she, Tammy?
Yes, I am a product of her education.
Well, that's great. You're being instructed by the best in the world, so good for you.
I am.
Does she have you wearing a helmet yet?
No, I haven't got there yet. I'm still a baseball cap kind of gal.
Okay, all right. She'll have you wearing a helmet in no time. That'll happen.
Probably so.
I've told this story before, but first time I actually met Tammy in person was years ago at the World Equestrian Games, and we had her on the show a number of times and had been talking to her a number of times, and I met her, and she had her horse trailer with her and her sleeping quarters horse trailer, and she said, come in here. And she started pulling guns out from everywhere. There was a gun in the refrigerator. I mean, there were guns underneath the mattress. There was a gun in the shower. And she said, here's all my guns. And she was just the same way. She's won about 1,000 belt buckles. Her wall's just covered in belt buckles.
Oh, yeah.
And yet she's still as excited about it as she was day one. I mean, it's just so cute.
I know.
Shooting guns apparently does something to people.
It kind of brings out the beast in us all.
I guess. You Texas girls, look out.
See, the only experience I have with guns is we have a fun activity that we did last summer, and we did mounted water pistol shooting on some pipelines. And that's my only claim to fame with
that
guns.
That is awesome.
The super soaker.
I love it.
It was great fun. You know, you had to like run down and scream. And I don't know how they do it, because like I kept trying to shoot with my right hand even when the target was on my left, and that didn't work out so well.
Melissa, there's a growing movement now, too, in mounted cart shooting. So actually doing it from a cart. Doing the same thing.
Yes.
Basically doing the same pattern, only you really need to learn to drive with one hand. That is one thing. But, that's becoming a thing now, too. So I think anything involving guns and Texas, you're going to have to put those two together. Congratulations for getting into that. I think you're going to have, look at you, in 5 years, you're going to have all those belt buckles on your wall, too.
Oh, slow down a little. I just graduated to level two, so. But, yeah, it's what I do to keep, to keep myself involved in the horse industry. And while I'm out there shooting, I do talk about, Coal River Equine and the benefits of the water and, what we're doing with these horses, with these fast, quick turns and the rollbacks and the stage after stage and sitting on their back for hours at a time. It's really nice to stick them in that pool and watch them get revitalized so that they can face another shoot. So, and we also sponsor prizes and packages at the shoot. So, if you wanted to get into the shooting, you just may take home a package of AquaTread swims. So,
well, that's terrific. I definitely am going to be looking into the AquaTread here in Ocala. I'm sure we have them in Florida here, and maybe take my pony for a swim. I just think that would be so cool to see him do it. And now that I know it's affordable, which I didn't realize before, that's definitely something I'm going to take a look at.
Yeah, it's very affordable.
What's your
website?
What is your website? Where can people find you?
Oh, you can find me easily at coldriverequine.com. And that's COLD, in case I have a southern accent, it sounds like cold.
COLD, riverequine.com. And all right, very good. Well, we have our next guest on the line here today. We have Spencer Williams, who is a horse husband. We'll have a lot to relate to here. And Spencer, you call yourself a rescue horse husband. I'm America's horse husband. You're a rescue horse husband. But we both, I think, married into this, right?
That's absolutely right. I really didn't know anything about horses until I got tangled up with my wife about 20 years ago.
And did you want to know anything about horses? Because I didn't at the beginning. I had no desire to marry a horse girl. It was not like I set out to do that. That happened by accident.
Yeah, I like horses. I mean, I had done some sort of trail rides, when I've, been on trips and so forth. And my grandfather had cattle, but he never really had a horse. But, so I was interested. I think what I always say is I had no idea what I was getting into. It was really, sort of a seismic shift in my life after that.
We really should write a book, the Horse Husband 101. And then with the first couple of chapters should just be warning them of all the things that are going to happen. And then we can go in, if you decide then after the first couple of chapters to stay on this course, this is what's going to happen after. So we can give them the warnings ahead of time that they have time to bail out, like after the first three chapters. And then if they keep going, they're stuck. Have to teach them how to deal with it after.
That's right. I mean, two things. It could be sort of a choose your own adventure. This is if you choose to allow your wife to buy her 16th saddle, turn to page 47.
That's right. I love your. That's great. We need to do this, Spencer. We need to do this.
As long as you let me write the Jeff Foxworthy style chapter, you might be a horse husband if. Ever found horse treats in your favorite winter coat, you might be a horse husband.
Yes. There's a whole ton of those, for sure.
I think it might be an international bestseller.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's give it a ride.
We need to get this done. I mean, you've got 20 years, I've got 30. That's 50 years of horse husbandhood that we have to draw from. And I've made all the mistakes. So, I've made them all along the way, and I'm sure you have, too.
Spencer has – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I don't know if it was a mistake or not, but, trying to be a supportive husband, I mean, that's what we want to be. I actually built my wife a 48 by 36 barn with 7 stalls and a tack room and about 20 feet tall. So I don't know if that was a mistake or not, but we'll have to put our heads together on whether that's the case.
And then, and it's going to relate back to what we're going to talk about next, Horse Husband Blues. You're also a singer-songwriter, and I love your music. I was listening to it this morning before the show, And we're going to play Rescue Husband Blues here very shortly after we're done with your interview. We're going to play that for everybody if you'll let us. But it's a great song, by the way. And we can all relate. I mean, we can all relate to that if you're a horse husband. But you, when you build a barn with 7 stalls, it means you're going to have 12 horses. When you build a barn with 12 stalls, it means you're going to have 17 horses. That number of stalls has nothing to do with the amount of horses. Am I right?
It's horse math. That's absolutely right. We have a good friend who, so as you know, we do horse rescue, or my wife is, right, you know, dedicated her life to this. And so we have another friend who's participated in this, and occasionally she would take in a foster horse without telling her husband. And what she said is, just be sure you send me a chestnut one, because I've got 4 chestnuts out there. He won't notice another one.
You never know the difference.
I said that about my landlord, is I'm supposed to have 4, but extra gray horses keep showing up, and they don't seem to know the difference.
Yeah, that one's just here for a day. It'll be gone tomorrow. It'll be fine. Everything's good. Well, now, it's Blue Bonnet Equine is the name of the rescue. Now, when you got married initially, was there a rescue in the picture, or did that come later?
It actually came very soon after we got married. We were together for a couple of years before we got married, and we sort of became involved with a woman who, you know, we were really young and didn't recognize what was going on. And essentially, about a year later, the woman died, and all of her horses were seized by the county, or taken in by the county, because she had died. And, you know, we had been unable to help them to this point, you know, for various reasons. So my wife sat down, she did a lot of research, as she, you know, that's sort of one of her strengths, and she found out what would have to happen in order for her to be able to help those horses. And we didn't wind up being able to help them. Fortunately, they were you know, put into a better place by the woman's son. So they all managed to, you know, come out of it okay. But what really came out of that experience was Jennifer's passion for helping horses, and it's really snowballed from there. I think the rescues that we've been involved with have taken and helped directly about 1,500 horses, and hopefully several thousand more. And as a matter of fact, we have a couple of them here fostering at our ranch here just south of Waco. And we've been basically a continuous foster home for rescues, you know, since about 1999.
So you're kind of the foster home?
Yeah, so Blue Bonnet operates through a system of foster homes, and we feel like this is the best way to get horses the individual attention that they need and understand where they're coming from and what they need also. So we've been a foster home for a long time. It's definitely the best way, you know, to contribute to the need. And so we do that, you know, we, of course, Jennifer being the executive director, we have a lot of other responsibilities. But being a foster home has been really rewarding for both of us. Even though I'm not that much of a horse person, as I always say, my guitar has never tried to buck me off, and so I'm generally more comfortable with my guitar. But, you know, having these horses around, as I always say, if I'm getting into heaven, it's on Jennifer's coattails, because she dedicates so much of her life to helping them.
It's interesting that both of our wives are named Jennifer, too. Really should write this book.
We really should write that book, yeah.
Yeah, because then in the book, think about this. In the book, when we say the name Jennifer, they'll not know which one it is, so we can get away with more.
I think we could do that. Yeah, send me over an outline, yeah, and we'll get started.
All right, Spencer. Well, now, how did you get started writing music?
Well, I was in high school band. I've always loved music. And after I left high school, I decided, well, nobody really wants you to pull out your French horn at a party. And so I asked my parents for a guitar for Christmas
one year.
Funny
about the French horn that way.
Exactly, yeah. It's not exactly a campfire instrument, no. So I sort of taught myself. I had some lessons, you know, here and there. And I guess now, wow, I guess I've been playing for about 25 years now. At some point, I just, I got into bluegrass and folk music more. I'd kind of liked that. And I just decided for one reason or another to give it a try. And, you know, sort of I've been fortunate enough to have a little bit of success with this, but it's the thing, it's my version of messing with horses, you know, it really renews me, and it's just something that I'm really drawn to.
So do you play gigs, or do you count on just selling the songs online? Do you do both?
Well, I've sold them online. I'm sort of on hiatus at the moment. My day job has taken over my life for the last couple of years, even into the evenings, and so I haven't had much time to do actual gigging. I was playing the farmer's market up here in Waco a bit, and I had a sort of a recurring gig at a bar down in College Station, but just haven't had a lot of time to chase that side of my dreams. Been, spending my time being a scientist.
I was going to ask you, what's your real job? I'm always interested in that too.
Well, I don't know if it's my real job or not. My real job might be, I'll tell you about the one that pays the bills. How about that?
Okay, yeah.
So right, I'm a member of the faculty at Baylor University in the environmental sciences and biology departments.
Oh, cool.
I'm a professional nerd. I'm a professional nerd. That's really what it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, you've got a diverse thing going there, though, with the music and being a scientist and then also over on the shoveling poop side of things. Which I know you've done plenty of in your lifetime. Tell us a little bit about the song we're going to play, Rescue Husband Blues.
Well, you know, we all got into this. There was a, you know, when we first started the first rescue, it was called Lone Star, Equine Rescue, really great organization. And there were about 20 or 25 of us, and mostly the people who were involved were women, I noticed, and a lot of the husbands or significant others, you know, we were basically the beasts of burden. We would support in whatever way we could. But, you know, like I say, just as in with getting into horses, I didn't really know what I was getting into. We definitely didn't. And so there was some, you know, scratching of heads and dark muttering under our breaths. And we, you know, we would sort of get together and commiserate. And this song became a way for me to, you know, help some of these other husbands make the transition. Just here's what you're getting into. Just wanted to let you know.
Well, it's terrific, too. Alice, I know you're doing a fundraising ride here shortly. Why don't you tell everybody about that again?
It's called Without a Trace. It's at Trace Trails in Athens, Texas on May 2nd and 3rd. And I have my quilt raffle. But if anybody that hears this is interested in a raffle ticket, you don't have to be present to win. And there's pictures. I can send pictures. There's pictures everywhere on my Facebook page. All the proceeds will go to Bluebonnet. And I hope we can raise a lot of money for them to help pay for all the things that horses need.
Well, I know that running a rescue is a very expensive operation because most of the time you have a need for a lot of medicines and vet bills, and that really does run up the bill. We're used to, you know, not having so many vet bills with our horses here at home, but I know you guys deal with that, and it is a major expense for you in your medicines.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, we get just a diversity of horses coming in, you know, from law enforcement cases, from astray horses, and you know, you just never really know what you're going to get. You know, it's pretty frequent someone will tell us, hey, I've got a mare for you to come pick up, and it winds up being a stallion, or a gelding winds up being a stallion, or we've even had a couple of geldings wind up being mares. And then, you know, you'll have a horse that needs more feed, you'll have horses that need specialized treatment, and one of the things that's sort of unappreciated is the need to move these horses around within the state, you know, to get them to the right foster home or close to a potential adopter where they can come and have, you know, an experience meeting their potential adopted horse. It's definitely not an easy operation to run, but it's one that we felt really good about being a part of, you know, for the last, Lone Star was founded in 1999. Bluebonnet was founded in 2005. So we've been doing this a while.
Bluebonnetequine.org is the website. Where can people buy your music?
Well, right now you can buy it through PayPal. Go to my website. It's cowboyspencer.com and look at the store link. Feel free to send me an email and I'll make sure to and mention the show, and I'll be happy to give you a good deal on a CD and get it right out to you.
All right, cowboyspencer.com. Let's take a listen to what I think is now my new favorite horse song. That's Rescue Husband Blues. Thanks, Spencer.
Thank you.
Well, I knew I was in trouble when my wife saw this old horse. He's a pathetic thing, and she said, we've just got to take him home. Know that we can feed him up and get him back on his feet. Next thing I know, there's 14 more in my wife's rescue elite. suddenly she's getting 15,000 emails a day. Most of them from people trying to send another horse our way. A few times I tried to put the brakes on, but it was just too late. She hypnotized 14 other wives all across the state. Well, I guess there's worse obsessions that my darling wife could choose. That sure don't stop me from having the rescue husband blues. We foster 1,000 horses, most whose names I can't recall. But at least I know a little piece of my wallet went out with them all. Now my wife loves the horses, and I've just had to accept that. Having a little more trouble with these 40 dogs and cats. Everything was fine until they commandeered my chair. Covered every piece of clothing I owned with piles and mounds of hair. Next thing you know, I'm gonna be renting another house. Cause the animals will unionize and quickly vote me out. I'd like to think my wife will side with me when that day comes. But I don't know, she's got little ears for creatures with opposable thumbs. I guess there's worse obsessions that my darling wife could choose. That sure don't stop me from having the rescue husband blues. We fostered 1,000 horses, most whose names I can't recall. But at least I know a little piece of my wallet went out with them all. Now I know some of you fellas out there can surely sympathize. Same thing's been going on at your house and with your darling wife. So let's start us up a club. Let the meeting start. If there's a whole lot of Shinerbach beer in misery, come on and do your part. We've got the rescue husband blues. Sure don't got no money left to lose. Let's get together and talk about the days before our wives are rescue slaves and drink away these old rescue husband blues. Just can't shake these rescue husband blues.
Spencer Williams with Rescue Husband Blues. Again, you can find all of his music at cowboyspencer.com. And I think we'll be playing a few more of his songs as we go along here on the morning show as well. He has some other fun ones, but check him out at cowboyspencer.com. And, of course, the website for the rescue is bluebonnetequine.org. Well, let's go head over to our next guest. I'm excited to talk to her.
Yes, Becky Rogers, NATRC Horsemanship Judge. She has also been competing for over 10 years, and she and her husband own Marker Sellers, and they're the sponsor of our show today.
Good morning, Becky.
Good morning. I wish you would have had a bottle of our wine yesterday for your celebration.
I know. I wish I would have, too.
I know. What did you have? Orange Coke?
Your wine is some concoction?
Yeah, I made my own concoction of an amaretta and orange soda. By the way, it was pretty good, I got to say.
Yeah.
I'm regretting it this morning, though.
Sounds delicious.
I'll tell you what. You send me a bottle of your wine, and I promise to drink it on a show.
Oh,
there you go.
That's a deal. It's a deal.
I'd be happy to do that. I don't have any trouble with that at all, actually, Becky. That'd be fine.
Sounds like a challenge.
Twist my arm. Yeah, twist my arm. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Becky, I wanted you to tell us a little bit about how you got started in an ATRC.
How I got started. Well, I think I was destined to be an ATRC since I was a little girl. I rode my sister's blind horse, Sugar Babe, in games and barrel poles and things like that. But you really had to learn to ride with a blind horse because, of course, the horse couldn't see, so you really had to do the riding. And then when she passed away, I wanted my own horse, So I saved money up to buy a horse, and I don't know how old you guys are, but back then, babysitting was 50 cents an hour. So I babysit, I mowed yards, I did some sewing, and I earned $125. So my dad took me to the sale barn to buy a horse, and the only thing $125 would buy was a horse named Wild Eye, who reared up immediately on me. So my dad matched funds, and I saw a little gray horse that I fell in love with instantly named Carla, and she didn't like games, but she did like trail riding, and she was a trail riding fool. So I rode her miles and miles and miles. When we would get home from school, my girlfriends and I would jump on the horses and ride. We had a dam behind our house, so we rode for miles and miles. And then my parents let me go on the Southern Trail Ride every year, and it was a week-long trail ride, so I got to be out of school for a week during high school, 4 years in a row. And we rode from Brim, Texas to Houston, Texas for the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, which was about 120 miles, I would say. So we would ride 20 miles a day. So anyway, I grew up loving trail riding. And I actually named the horse Carla Bars because she was a great horse that most of my friends had registered horses. So I pretended she was registered and called her Carla Bars. And then later in life, I named my daughter Carla after her because I loved her so much.
I was going to ask you that. I was like, wait a minute, isn't your daughter named Carla? That's funny.
Yeah, my daughter loves to tell that story that she was named after a horse.
So how did you hear about NATRC?
Oh, NATRC. Well, that's a funny story. I was actually in a disciple Bible study class, and I was doodling a lot during the speakers, and I drew horses all over my paper, and a gentleman sitting next to me named George Campbell was seeing the horses, and so at break we would talk horses, and we would be late back to the Bible study, but we would, you know how when two horse people get together, what that turns into. So we talked and talked, and he told me about NATRC, which he called NATRAC, and we started riding together, and he started mentoring me, and I actually went on my first ride with him in October of 01. The San Houston Ride in East Texas.
Okay. So, what type of horse were you riding when you first started to compete?
Another funny story. So my daughter, my older daughter had a Hunter Jumper little pony. Well, not pony, little 14 hands, little pony. And so I pulled him out of the pasture. His name was Skywalker, and we called him Herschel Skywalker. So we pulled this little Hunter Jumper pony out of the pasture, and I started riding him on the rides. And my first ride, George taught me some things on the trail, but you just never know it all. So on my first ride, the judges asked us to do a side pass. Excuse me. So I turned to the lady behind me, and I go, okay, I get it. I get the concept. It says side pass. Obviously, you're going to go sideways, but can you tell me how to do it? And she goes, sure. You just, like, hold your rein like this, and you kick on the other side, and your horse will go. Well, when I got up to the side pass, you know what happened? Absolutely nothing. And so I went home, and I looked at my judge's card and decided to learn how to do the side pass. So I learned. Worked, and finally the horse did the side pass. But also there was a gate on that ride, and it was a long gate for a car gate, and it had a rope on the end of it. And I watched competitor after competitor walk up to the gate, lean down, open the gate, and almost fall off their horse. So when I went up to it, I asked the judge, do you mind if I use that rope? And she goes, oh, my gosh, I wish you would, because no one else has. And so I took the rope, opened the gate, closed the gate, and I got an excellent on that because she, that night at the ride briefing, she said, someone thought outside the box. And so after that, I was hooked because this was a sport that you could really think and your horse could learn and you could learn, and the rest is history.
So after your first horse,
I know you changed to another horse that was a Spanish Mustang. Can you tell us a little bit about Thief of Hearts and how he enhanced your love for the sport?
Oh, yes. So the show that you were talking about, the American Indian show, he is actually from Marshall, Texas, from there. And after a ride one afternoon, I came at the end of the ride, and I saw this gray horse tied to a trailer over there. And I said to my friend, there's my dream horse. And she goes, why? I said, I don't know. There's just something about that horse. And she goes, well, let's go talk to the owner. And so I went over to talk to the owner, and I go, my goodness, I'm in love with this horse. Tell me about him, blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, funny you should ask. He might be for sale because my husband thinks I have too many horses. So about 6 months later, I got the call, and I got Thief of Hearts. And I just love him. We have the bond that Carla and I had through the years, which is amazing, because I never thought there would be another horse that I was as close to as Carla. But he went on. He's one of the horses that you can compete and win in spite of yourself. I mean that sometimes you're not paying attention or your mind is somewhere else, but your horse stays stable and passes those hogs on the trail or passes the sheep and goats and things that you see on the trail and doesn't pay any attention to it, just pays attention to what their task is.
So, what made you decide to become a judge, and what are some of the steps in the process?
Why did I decide to become a judge? Well, when you're in NATRAC, you're so lucky to be among so many people that are knowledgeable in the horse world, and competing for 10 years and volunteering, I had the opportunity to learn so much from the horsemanship and the vet judges. You learn safety, you learn the physical, the emotional, the mental teaching of the horses, and I learned so much from them, and I was between horses. I was giving Thief of Hearts a break, and a couple of the judges that are in their 70s now said that they were trying to get some younger people, not that I'm so young, but trying to get some younger people in there, and so they asked me if I would like to become a horsemanship judge, and I thought about it, and I feel so lucky to be in this sport and to meet so many people, and as Tammy said, you get to go from region to region, and everywhere you go, you meet friends because you have all the same common likes, and you want the best for your horse, as all of us horse people do. And so anyway, I just said, why not? Let's do it. And so I just started doing the steps, which are long. You have to complete at least 10 open division rides, and then you need 100% horsemanship points over a couple years. And as Tammy said, sometimes you get 8-10 points. You can get 18 points if you sweepstake your class, which means you get the highest point of the horse of the heavyweight or the lightweight. And so anyway, it takes a while to get 100 points. And then you need to serve as the secretary to the horsemanship and the vet judge. You need to manage a competitive trail ride, which is, as Alice can tell you, it's a lot. You have up to 60 riders, and you have up to 30 to 40 volunteers, and you work with the Forest Service or the state park or wherever you're at. And so anyway, you manage your ride, and then you have to be proficient at taking PNRs, and you need 6 references. And so you have to be in good standing with people and not burn any bridges. And so anyway, you have to have 6 references, 4 in your own region, and 2 or more have to be judges. And I actually got 6 judges to be my references. And then you take a long horsemanship test. And then you have to judge 7 rides as an apprentice. 1 is a mentor, and it's wonderful because you have a judge with you the whole weekend, and there's a judge that's judging the ride, but there's also a horsemanship judge with you, and every step of the way. So you look at all the obstacles, you look, go to the PNRs, you just see from the back looking in, and you talk about how you would judge this and how you would judge that and things like that. And then you have, so that's your mentor one. And then you have three with other horsemanship judges who are actually judging the ride. And then you have three alone by yourself. And so
I'll tell you, this is a longer process than the A judges in dressage on FEI level. You guys have to work for this.
It is a lot, but there's a lot to learn, and each judge judges just a little bit differently. So it's good to see the perspective of all the judges. So Tammy Lineback actually judges a ride in Georgia, and I was one of her judges for one of my first provisional rides, and that was a lot of fun. But the people in NATRC, as a rule, are so helpful. The competitors are helpful, the judges are helpful, and so it's nothing to be afraid of. You know, it's a wonderful process. I never felt alone. I never felt like I was thrown into it. But
not after all of that. You would know what you're doing. That's for sure. Now tell us, before we run out of time, how did you and your husband get in the wine business? Did you have anything to do with it before then?
We lived in California. We got the bug. We lived there for 8 years, and we went up and down the Central Coast. And one of our favorite wineries was Best Parker Winery in Rosalito. And so when we moved back to Texas, we planted grapes, and we started making wine, 5 gallons, 10 gallons, 20 gallons, 30 gallons. And then we entered a non-commercial wine contest with the Texas Grape Growers Association, and my husband won a few medals for non-commercial wine. And so he really got the bug then. And he went to Grayson Viticulture and Enology School. It's about an hour away from us in Denison, Texas. And actually, the professors from UC Davis come in on the weekends and teach there.
Oh,
and
right.
So he got his degree. Yeah, he got his degree.
I'm looking at your website here. It's markersellers.com. And you have tasting and tours available, but that's by appointment only. So you can check that out right on the website and give them a call if you're interested in that.
Well, we are here at Horses in the Morning, and of course it is the North American Trail Ride Conference. All right, Alice, you're up.
Okay. Well, our next guest is a brand new NATRC competitor. Her name is Mistin Milligan. I met Mistin in either March or April when she entered the competition that I manage. So she's here to talk about what it's like to get started from scratch in ATRC.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mistin. How are you today?
I am just fine. How is everybody over there?
Doing well. Tell us a little bit about how you got started riding, and then how that interest developed into distance riding.
Oh, well, I guess I have been riding off and on my whole life. I didn't actually own a horse until I was in my 20s, but, you know, when I was in elementary school, I had a best bud that had a pony, and so we went everywhere on that pony. And we had just, you know, fantastic time. And I just never outgrew my love of horses. You know, everybody said, oh, it's a phase. Well, it's not. And so when I was in my 20s, though, I really started riding. And so what did I do? I went to a barn that had off-track thoroughbred, which was great, right? And
it's a great way to learn, absolutely.
Great way to learn. Boy, you certainly learned how to sit really fast.
Wait a minute, we have a song for that.
Here green on green makes black and blue, wouldn't ride back.
See, there's a song for that.
And I learned the importance of having a helmet. And, but, you know, I really, I learned a lot there. I really, really did. And, you know, my first horse was an Anglo-Arab. And I think they saw me coming.
You went from thoroughbreds to Anglo-Arabs?
Yeah.
Yeah, you were a glutton for punishment.
That's like me wishing my that's like me wishing that Liberty was a quarter horse. You know, you don't get a hot horse and expect something calm.
Yeah.
But now I am quite a bit older. I'm in, you know, my mid-40s now, and I kind of don't really need those types of horses anymore. So now I just have an Arab Mustang Cross.
Yeah, that's sensible.
Oh, I love it. But she's older. I mean, she's 17, and she's been there, done that, very solid, you know, mare. And she's shorter, which is a real blessing at this point.
Hey, wait a minute. And, wait a minute. Wait a minute, guys. I see it now. It's a Musrab. Remember, we're coming up with names for the mixes? Well, there we have a Musrab. All right, we have to add that. Jennifer, write that down. That's going in our registry.
It could be an Air Tang.
It could.
Yeah.
Air Tang. Musrab.
I kind of really like Musrab.
Yeah, Musrab.
I think, yeah, Musrab is good. She's a Musrab.
Yeah.
Musrab. And she's, you know, about, oh, I don't know, 14, 3, 15 hands. And she's really wide. And, you know, she's just really been there, done that, very broke horse. And so she takes care of me out on the trail.
Unless her friends take off running, and then
so
much.
Yeah,
I've never done that.
Kill me in a day.
Never. Oops.
Yeah, and that was that is something. That's a good point for new riders. You know, Alice was talking about if you're riding open, the open riders don't really want you near them or following them. But if you're a novice rider, a novice on the trail like I am, you do pretty much want to stay with other riders. And I don't know what I was doing. I wasn't paying attention or something, but we were lollygagging around in the back, and Alice decided she was going to canter off, and my mare saw it before I did, and before you know it, woo, off we went. So,
I called it, but I forgot to look back and call it. I called it forward where there was no one to hear me. I'm going.
Yeah, that was fantastic. But you know, she's We stayed on and had a really good time in such. And also, I guess I started out in the English world doing a lot of hunting, of course, and things like that, and some low jumps. But now I ride mainly Western. And, you know, I really like to do Western dressage, and I do like to do a little bit of the reining patterns and stuff like that. But more than anything, my new love is really getting out on the trail.
So, what has been the biggest challenge to getting started in a distance sport?
The biggest challenge to getting started, well, for me personally, that would just be getting in good enough shape to really do it without, you know, compromising my horse. You know, because I'm your very typical middle-aged mom with a husband and two kids and with an office job. And so, you know, I really would have to work at it to be in better shape. And so my first Natrek ride, by the end of that ride, my legs were jelly, and I didn't know if I could walk, go get my ribbon. But, you know, but I sure enough did. And but that's the biggest thing, was just trying to get prepared and all the little things that you do have to learn. But I don't want people to be discouraged, because there's so much help out there. And all the people are really great. Like when Alice said, you know, we met and she took me to lunch after she discovered I had enrolled in her ride. And, you know, she really took me under her wing and has taught me so much about all the ropes. And we really are great buds now. And you really meet lots of new friends doing this. And so I would encourage anyone who's even thinking about it to at least go try it.
Yeah. What are some of the things you've been doing? Like, there's another sport that we participate in a little bit, too, that's more obstacle-based. It's called the Texas Trail Challenge Club. I know you've done, like, one of each. Did that help you? Because it was a little slower? Or tell me about that a little bit.
Well, actually, I enjoyed the Natrek ride better, because it's more about learning how to pace, and the obstacles were not as involved. And so whenever my mare really likes to go, so when we get out there, you know, she wants to go forward and move.
And, you know, I like to do that with her. It makes her happy, so I'm happy. And, but the Texas Trail Challenge, like Alice said, is really more obstacle-based. And they're fun obstacles, though. And I would say that it's actually harder because I do have a forward-moving horse. And that is another thing is that you have to practice those things because we got excused from the judge mount, three times? I think three times now we've been excused from the judge mount because my horse was not wanting to stand still while I was getting on her. So that's definitely something you have to work on.
Well, and don't you think it's something you have to practice out on the trail? Because at home, she stands perfectly still.
That's an excellent point. That's whenever you get out there with your horse, you're going to find out where all your holes are. There's something about the trail that it just brings it out in them. And you have to get out there. You have to practice on the trail. You have to be in that type of environment in order for them to really understand what they need to do. Yeah.
So when you started, what equipment were you missing that you now have that will help you be able to get out and ride more?
As far as equipment goes, one of the biggest things I've been looking for is a new saddle just because I'm looking for a lighter saddle. Like I said, I switched to Western. I ride in a Western equitation saddle with an Arabian tree because my horse is very wide. And so I'm kind of limited in my choice of the kind of tack I can put on her. But really, whenever you're starting out, you don't need a whole lot of specialized tack. You don't need to go out and spend, $1,000 on a new tack set. You need something that your horse is very comfortable in and that you can rely on and that you work in every day so that whenever you're out in the trail and you've got new obstacles coming at you, you're in your comfort zone already. You're not trying to mess with new tack or what fits and what doesn't. I still ride in my Western saddle and my leather bridle and, all of my regular stuff I always rode in. But it's, I need to invest in some saddle bags, even though I don't like them very much, and little things like that.
Yeah, Miston has a penchant for taking all our stuff off our saddles.
Yeah,
Her horse lives an hour away, and my horses live about 3 miles from where she lives. So sometimes she'll come and we'll just go riding from my place, and she'll take all our stuff off. And then we come back.
Seat
saver's gone.
Stuff on the saddle. Yeah. And they're like, oh, well, we know he's been riding in this saddle because everything's gone off of it.
I saw an article about don't go. It was titled "Don't Go Horseback Riding on a Trail Without One." It was like Trail Riding Magazine or one of them wrote this, and it was all of these things that you have to do when you're going on a trail ride. You have to bring along. Oh my God, you would need a percheron to carry everything that they listed on here.
Yeah, you really would. And one thing that people that do want to try Natrack is get a Camelback. For water, if you don't like a lot of stuff on your saddle, get something like that to carry your water. Otherwise, you're going to have like 6 water bottles, and you've got to have all the stuff to carry, that water in. And I remember my very first ride, I think I took like 2 bottles with me or something. And I was begging water. People would drive, trot by, and I'd be like, hey, have some water, hey.
I know a lot of the endurance riders use the Camelbacks. I've seen them using it.
Yes.
Makes sense.
Yes, it does. And I'm in the, I'm looking for one right now. As a matter of fact, I was going to go down to the sporting goods store and get one for this weekend.
So, do you have any goals, for your, as you start your NATRC career?
Goals. Yes. I was thinking about that last night actually. And, I was kind of considering 2014 my beginner/training year to kind of get to know the ropes and learn how to pace my horse and what type of obstacles are out there and what's really expected. And I think in 2015, my goals are to, number one, just compete in more rides, more Natrack rides, and finish them. If I do really well in them, then fantastic. But, for me, it's all about getting out there with my horse, doing things that I really didn't know if I could do or not, like going through ponds and over logs, because I was previously always strictly more of an arena rider, you know, and I know that Glenn was talking about that a little bit earlier. Whenever you actually get your horse out of the barn environment and you get them out onto a trail and you have time to a trailer and all those things that you have to do when you travel, you know, it's a whole new world. You don't know if you can really do it or not. You don't know if you're tying your horse right. You don't know if you've got the track, you know. And so it getting out there and doing all those things that you didn't think that you can do, guess what, you really can do them. And it does wonders for your confidence. If you have any type of confidence issues on your horse, it does wonders for you, and I would just highly recommend it because it certainly made a difference to me.
That's great. I'm glad that you feel more confident now than you did 6 months ago. It means that we've pulled you along and not turned you away.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And everyone is actually very helpful, both in the Trail Challenge Club that I'm a part of now, and also in NATRAC. I mean, all you have to do is go up and introduce yourself and ask, and people bend over backwards to give you the information you need or otherwise help you along. And, you know, for people that don't, you know, necessarily want to ride, or for some reason they can't bring their horse to a ride, go volunteer. I volunteered on the PNR crew for the first time this last weekend, or the weekend before the last NATRAC ride anyway. And I did PNRs, and I discovered so much about, you know, just the metabolics of the horse and how to do it. And, you know, it's a real learning experience. You never stop learning. I mean, if you really want a new challenge and something new that you're going to enjoy, then you need to give it a shot.
Well, and this year you've been doing, like, the one-day rides, where we have, in NATRC, we have the A rides, which are two-day rides, or we have the B rides, which are one-day rides. And what made you decide that the one-day ride was all you wanted to take on right now? Was it getting off after that first one-day ride?
Yeah. Are you falling off of my horse as I cross the finish line, that one? Yeah.
Did you?
No, I really did do that, but it felt like it.
Yeah, I didn't remember that.
Yeah, no, it felt like it, because whenever I dismount, I don't use my stirrups. I just usually kind of swing off. And so I did that after that first 15 miles and kind of crumpled. And I was like, oh, where'd my legs go? For the first few rides, you know, my mare, as hardy and as stout and as much heart as she has, I have to take care of her. She is 17. And so, you know, I wanted also, before I made a even more huge investment, you know, with the fees and everything else, because the B rides are a little less expensive, I needed to make sure that it was something we were going to enjoy. And it, like, you know, like you said, it was also a little shorter, which was going to be easier on both of us as, you know, our stamina builds. And as we get into better shape, then we can go on the two-day rides. I'm really actually very excited. I'm looking forward to my first two-day ride next year.
Glenn and Jamie will be back again tomorrow, folks. See you then.